Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for December 14th, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, wild salmon populations in peril, simulating a trip to Mars, storing light in an optical fiber, why old world monkeys are resistant to HIV/AIDS, and the upcoming International Year of the Reef. All this, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Two-thirds of the salmon people eat come from fish farms, which are commonly infested with a native parasite known as salmon lice. While adult salmon can live with the lice, many juvenile salmon cannot, including the pink salmon found in the Pacific, from Japan to Siberia to California. In a paper in this week's Science, Martin Kirkosek and colleagues show that the recurrent infestations of wild juvenile pink salmon are associated with exposure of the wild fish to salmon farms. As a result, wild pink salmon populations are facing local extinction just north of Vancouver. Science News writer Benjamin Lester spoke with Kirkosek from British Columbia.
Wherever salmon farms have spread in Norway, Ireland, Scotland, and Canada, we've seen a pattern of sea lice infestations of wild juvenile salmon in those areas. And this paper that we have coming out is the first one to really document how severe the impact is on wild salmon populations. It's a study that's on the west coast of Canada in an area called the Broughton Archipelago, and we're studying wild pink salmon, which are one of the most abundant Pacific salmon. And they're unique in the sense that they enter the ocean when they're really small. And when they enter the ocean, the adult salmon that usually carry sea lice, which is a natural parasite, are offshore. They haven't migrated back yet to spawn. And so that means for the first few months of marine life of these juvenile fish, they don't encounter the parasite. But what's happening now is when the juvenile salmon enter the ocean, the first thing they encounter are salmon farms, and the juvenile salmon get exposed to the sea lice when they're really far too small to be able to handle the parasite. It only takes one or two lice to kill a juvenile pink salmon.
What exactly are salmon lice?
They're a parasitic copepod, so they're crustaceans. They're related to things like shrimp and crab and lobsters, and they're marine, so they live in the ocean, not in fresh water. And they're ectoparasites, so they make their living on the surface of a fish. They eat the skin and mucus and blood and muscle, whatever they can get into.
And so why are they only becoming a problem now?
They're becoming a problem now because in the natural system, juvenile salmon have about a 3-month window between when they enter the ocean and when they would encounter the parasite. And during that time, they grow really rapidly. They grow scales. And by the time they encounter the parasite, they're large enough and robust enough to tolerate an infection. And what's happening with salmon farms is the juvenile salmon get exposed immediately when they enter the ocean, when they're very small, and the lice are lethal to the juvenile salmon.
So how do the lice get from the salmon farms to the natural populations?
Well, the salmon farms consist of a series of net pens. In each of the net pens, there's, you know, tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of salmon. And so an individual farm can have 500,000 or even over 1 million salmon in net pens. And because they're in net pens, that means there's a free exchange of materials between what's inside the farm and what's outside the farm. So whatever pathogens wild fish have, the farm salmon are exposed to them. And that's when they first get infected with sea lice from the wild fish. And then when the sea lice are on the farm fish, they can reproduce. And when they reproduce, they hatch out these planktonic larvae, which are free-floating for about a week. And it's during that stage that the lice disperse from a salmon farm into the surrounding environment. And the juvenile salmon usually have to migrate past several farms before they make it out to the ocean.
What are going to be the long-term results of this?
Well, what we've seen is since sea lice infestations began in the Broughton Archipelago, the wild pink salmon populations have been declining, and they've been declining very rapidly. Based on that rate of decline, it's going to take them about 8 years to go from their historical abundance to extinction. And we're already 4 years into that decline, so they're halfway there. So it's a fairly tenuous situation. Extinction is imminent, and it's clear that serious management actions are necessary to turn the situation around.
You say extinction. That's a pretty dire term.
It is, and that is the situation. I have to be specific to say that it's local extinction, so we're talking about the pink salmon populations in the Broughton Archipelago that are exposed to the sea lice, not extinction for the entire species throughout, you know, the Pacific Basin.
So this lice-caused decline is only starting. There must have been some sort of extrapolation that you used to predict the local extinction of the species.
Sure. So we've seen four generations of pink salmon get subjected to sea lice infestation. And that's four generations from seven different populations. And from those data, we can calculate the population growth rate. And so are the populations increasing or are they decreasing? And they've been decreasing. They've been decreasing very rapidly. And so from those data, we know that the pink salmon populations have been impacted by the sea lice. And based on that rate of decline, we can then predict when those populations would reach extinction if the sea lice infestations continue.
Is there a number of generations at which you're going to feel more confident about your data, or are you fully confident of it now?
Right now, we have enough data to get robust estimates on the growth rates, and the rate of decline is so steep that it's really arresting. It makes you stop in your tracks and realize that something has to happen immediately to turn the situation around. Certainly, you can study the fish for years and years and years, and the more data you have, the more robust your conclusions will be. But if we wait another 10 years to get more data, based on what we're seeing right now, the fish are going to be long gone.
Weren't the farms in place specifically to prevent that from happening? To provide enough fish?
Well, yeah. And so there's a larger context here, and it has to do with how are we going to feed fish to humanity? The global demand for seafood is so large that wild fisheries can't meet that anymore. And this creates what's called a fish gap. And that gap is being met by aquaculture. And that's why we see such a rapid growth in salmon farming. But what we're seeing in the Broughton Archipelago, and really this is a bellwether case, that the current model that we're using to raise fish in farms in net pens can have huge consequences for the ecology of diseases and can have huge consequences for the ecosystems that these salmon farms are in. In the Broughton Archipelago, the sea lice outbreaks are so severe that wild pink salmon simply can't survive in that ecosystem anymore. And so rather than creating a net gain to the world's supply of fish, we see a situation where aquaculture can actually contribute to the demise of ocean fisheries and ecosystems.
So what sort of strategies are people looking at to change the way aquaculture is done in these areas?
Well, for sea lice and salmon, it's clear that we need to separate the fish that are inside the salmon farm from the wild fish that are migrating by. And there's a couple of ways to do that. The first, most obvious one is simply to move the salmon farms out of the way. Don't put them on the migration routes. Don't put them near salmon spawning rivers. Maybe put them offshore. Another possible alternative is to move to what's called closed containment technology, which means replacing the net pen with an actual physical barrier. And so there is no longer a free exchange of materials between the inside of the farm and the outside environment. And that's a solution that will go a lot further than just solving the sea lice problem. It'll solve problems that have to do with pollution. It would solve problems that have to do with other types of diseases. Sea lice are just the first thing that people have been studying because they're easy to study. You can see them and count them on the fish. But there's a whole host of other viral and bacterial diseases that we know are getting transmitted between wild and farmed fish. They're just really difficult to study.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Martin Kirkosek speaking with Science News writer Benjamin Lester. Kirkosek is lead author of a paper on declining wild pink salmon populations. Read the paper in this week's Science. Many governments are now considering plans to send people to Mars. While most of the missions are not planned for decades, and the trip itself takes months, science correspondent and gonzo scientist John Bohannon has already gone to Mars and come back in a simulated trip of his own. But before embarking on his journey, he stopped first at the United Nations.
I'm visiting the United Nations today, but not the one in New York. I'm at the UN compound in Vienna, Austria. I'll bet you didn't know the UN was in Austria, but trust me, it is. Upstairs is the International Atomic Energy Agency, and also, just as important, the UN Office of Outer Space Affairs. UNOOSA, as no one calls it, has invited the world's children, and me, to come learn about outer space and how to get to Mars.
My name is Anna May, and I'm 10 years old.
This is one of my fellow space cadets. Do you want to go to Mars? That's what I really want to know.
No, it's kind of hard to go, and then you can die if you go backwards. And it's...
But who should go?
You should.
Excellent answer. What my young comrade does not realize is that I am going to Mars. I leave tonight. Now, I'm not doing this alone. Besides my training day here at the UN, I've been advised by a space expert.
My name is Gernot Grömer. I'm working for the Austrian Space Forum at the University of Innsbruck, and I'm right now doing my PhD on astrobiology.
Grömer went to Mars in 2003. Well, he didn't really go to Mars. It was a two-week simulation at the Mars Desert Research Station in Utah. Grömer liked it so much that he repeated the simulation last year, and he plans to do it again in the Arctic. He's one of the world's most experienced simulated astronauts. And when he heard about my plans to go to Mars, he was behind me 100%.
So, John, you're embarking on a grand adventure about only 400 people have been doing before you. So good luck, stick to the procedures, and Godspeed.
The European Space Agency plans to send humans to Mars by 2035. NASA has its own mission with a target date of 2037. And now the Chinese want to join in. When I'm in my 60s, the party's going to be on Mars. But all I ever hear about is how difficult it is to get there. It's always cosmic radiation this and deadly space illness that. For my simulated journey to Mars, I wanted to focus on the question that no one is asking. Not, is it possible to send humans to Mars? But rather, is life in space any different from my apartment?
3, 2, 1, liftoff.
AAA's command, this is Captain Jan Bohannon aboard the RV Gonzo, currently 20 million kilometers from Earth en route to Mars.
Stand by for transmission of ship's
log 51007, transmitting.
It's been an excellent first day in space. I'm now farther from Earth than anyone has ever traveled, and I'm alive to tell you about it. So, I celebrated this morning in style with a space bath.
It's hot.
Technically, this was my first breach of Grömer's protocol.
First day, do not shower.
Oops.
The less water you use, the cheaper the mission gets, and every liter you save costs tens of thousands of dollars less of money for a real mission.
What's on the space menu? Grömer told me that the first thing to consider in designing good space food is...
water. Any kind of powder to make the water taste like milk powder, chocolate powder, coffee powder, and so on.
After a nice mug of powdered milk and dehydrated cocoa beverage, I decided to cook my first soup. Whole day, Grummer's been in my head like a backseat chef.
Lots of spices.
And by the way, Mom, Dad, Sis, hi. I know I've been a bit mysterious about this trip, not actually going to Marseille. That was a lie. Going to Mars. Red planet. Didn't have time to explain. Sorry about that.
That was day one from science correspondent John Bohannon's simulated trip to Mars. If you would like to hear and read more about his simulated trip, go to www.sciencemag.org/SCIEXT/gonzoscientist. Many of the world's information networks are linked with fiber optic cables, which convey pulses of light to transmit data. Storing that data, however, means converting the light to electrical signals and using standard memory in a computer. That conversion costs time and generates a lot of heat. In a paper in this week's Science, Daniel Gauthier and colleagues describe a way to avoid that costly conversion by storing the light directly in the optical fiber itself, converting the optical data into acoustical energy, or sound waves, and back again using only light. I spoke with Gauthier from his office at Duke University in North Carolina.
The main idea behind the work is to take a beam of light, or a little pulse that we've chopped out from that beam of light, and store that information for some brief interval. And in our case, we are storing it in an optical fiber. The optical fibers are underground and transmit most of the information back and forth across the world nowadays. And the real problem that we have with these systems is that we don't have something like a random access memory that are in all our computers. There's no way for us to store a piece of information and then recall it at some later time if that information is entirely contained in light, in pulses of light. Right now, many systems that do use light for transmitting information will often convert those signals to an electronic signal and then use standard computer memory to store that information, recall it back later, and then recreate pulses of light. And our project, as well as other research that's been going on for the last several years in our community, is trying to figure out a way that we can just take the pulse of light and store it so we don't have to go through this optical to electronic and back to optical conversion.
What's the disadvantage of making that conversion from light to electronic system and back to light?
This is always a slippery answer to be giving because the electronic technology continues to improve all the time. But I can at least give you the arguments that people have. The conversion from electronic and back to optical, again, dissipates energy, which usually shows up in the form of heat. And the rate at which heat is being generated is proportional to the square of the data rate. Now, it's a little bit mathematical, but it's a rather rapid increase that as the data rate gets faster and faster, you dissipate a lot more energy or create a lot more heat in the device that's doing this conversion. And in the current systems, it's possible to handle this heat generation. But in the future systems that are envisioned not all that far down the road, it's expected that the heat generation process is going to be overwhelming and that we really need to go to a system that runs entirely in the optical domain where we don't have to create an electrical signal.
So you're able to do this in the optical fibers themselves that are already a part of our modern fiber optic network?
That's correct, because in the generation of a sound wave, the process does not require that we match any resonance of a material. Rather, it can work anywhere over the range where the material is transparent. So for the optical fibers that are currently underground, they are specifically used in wavelength regions where the fiber is very transparent. And hence, our technique can work anywhere where the current systems are currently in operation.
So the light pulses that you're sending in are generating acoustical vibrations.
So in this process, there's a physical effect known as electrostriction. And this is when two laser fields interact in a transparent material, you'll get interferences. You'll have regions where the light pulses interfere destructively and there's no light in some space-time regions. And in other places, there is a high intensity of light. And when you have that variation, that spatial variation of light, that causes, through this electrostriction process, the material to become slightly higher or slightly lower in density. So essentially, you're creating a density wave or a pressure wave in the material. And a pressure wave is just a sound wave.
How exactly does that store data?
In our experiment, we send two laser beams into the optical fiber. One we call a right pulse, and that travels in one direction along the fiber. And then we send a stream of data pulses in the opposite direction. As the two sets of pulses pass through each other in the fiber, they interfere and induce an acoustic wave. And we set the process up so that energy is removed from the data pulse and put into both the right pulse as well as into the sound wave in the fiber. So essentially, we're removing all the energy from the data pulses and putting some of it into a sound wave and some of it into the right pulse. And after the right pulse leaves the material, there's just a sound wave that's left behind.
Propagating through the optical fiber.
The sound wave does propagate, but it really doesn't propagate all that much over the duration of the optical pulses. So essentially, we think of them as if they were stationary during the entire time interval of our experiment. But in fact, they are propagating a very small amount.
So then the read pulse comes along to pull the data out?
Right. So then we have this sound wave that's sitting there in the fiber. And anytime you have a sound wave, there's a difference in the density or difference in pressure in the glass that makes up the optical fiber. So you're going to change a property that's known as the refractive index of the material. And refraction is what makes a prism work or allows light to bend when it goes from one material into another. It also can create scattering of light. That is, it can take a beam of light and put it into a new direction. So in the whole process of writing and then reading out the data, we take optical data pulses that come in, essentially remove all their energy and put some of that into the acoustic wave and some into the right pulse. And when we send in the read pulse, all the energy is taken out of the sound wave and put back into the data pulses.
How efficient is this?
If we store only for a short period of time, then we get pretty good efficiency, somewhere around 30% efficiency from the energy that was originally in the data pulses to the energy of the data pulse that were released from the fiber. Now, the longer we try to store the data, the weaker and weaker are the pulses that are read out.
Well, practically speaking then, for modern optical information systems, how long are your storage times and are they long enough?
The storage times right now are around 10 nanoseconds, where a nanosecond is a billionth of a second. So we're storing the pulses for about 10 billionths of a second. But what's important for us is the shortness of the data pulses that we're sending in. The data pulses themselves are only 1 billionth of a second, so we're storing them for roughly 10 widths of the pulses that we are storing in the material. And right now, that is a relatively good milestone to be demonstrating in this first proof of concept experiment. But even with this short duration, there are certain mathematical operations that we can perform on these data pulses that might be of interest to people. The real key for improving our technique boils down to a materials issue. But we think that there are some new classes of glass materials that have a considerably longer lifetime and have a much stronger electrostriction effect.
Meaning that you'd have to perhaps change out the fiber optics that are present currently in order to have this system available commercially?
That's right. If we were to improve the behavior of our system, we would have to incorporate a different material in the fiber. But the materials that we're focusing on are ones that can be in an optical fiber format. So it would be very straightforward to couple light from the existing fiber optic systems into a short section of fiber that we would use for this memory and then couple it back into the standard fiber. So we're convinced that there are several good candidates out there that are in a format that would be easily integrated into current technology.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Daniel Gauthier is a senior author of a paper on storing light in an optical fiber. Read the paper in this week's Science. The human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, joins a long list of retroviruses that have assailed humankind over the millennia. In fact, our genomes are scattered with remnants of past encounters with retroviruses, but encounters that have ultimately ended in attrition. In contrast, the battle between humans and HIV is still in full swing. But as science editor Stephen Simpson reports from the award ceremony for the GE and Science Essay Prize in Stockholm this week, evidence is emerging to suggest that our genomes may also contain the evolutionary means to resist HIV.
One of the biggest puzzles in the field of HIV research is why the virus fails to cause AIDS in monkeys of the old world, where it is thought to have first emerged. This has led scientists to ask exactly what it is about these species of monkey that shields them from HIV, and whether humans might latently possess a similar means of protection. I'm in Stockholm, Sweden with Matt Stremlau to talk with him about some of his own work on understanding HIV resistance. Dr. Stremlau is here this week to receive a grand prize for his essay entitled Why Old World Monkeys Are Resistant to HIV-1, which was published on the 7th December issue of Science. As he explains, this story of HIV resistance centers on a protein carried inside our cells called TRIM5-alpha.
TRIM5-alpha is an intracellular factor which we think its primary function is to resist infection by retroviruses. It's part of a rather large family of proteins called the tripartite motif family of proteins, whose cellular functions at this point are not very clear.
So could you elaborate on how you think the protein helps resist HIV? For example, does it act directly on the virus, or does it influence other pathways that have antiviral effects? Or indeed, are we not sure at this point what the protein actually does in functional terms?
We know that the blocked HIV infection in old world monkey cells occurs just after the virus enters the cell, during a poorly understood step known as capsid uncoating. And we think that TRIM5-alpha associates with the incoming viral capsid and causes that capsid to prematurely disassemble. We're unsure right now what the consequences are of this rapid disassembly, but we think that the rapid disassembly of the capsid is detrimental to the viral life cycle and prevents the virus from continuing through its life cycle.
And your work has also centered on the finding that in old world monkeys, TRIM5-alpha protects against HIV virus, while in the human form of the protein, it doesn't. But do you have any idea why this is so?
Yeah, the human homolog TRIM5-alpha has very modest antiviral activity against HIV-1, and we believe that's because it's unable to associate with the incoming viral capsid. Human TRIM5 has a single amino acid in its C-terminal spry domain, which is a positively charged amino acid, which we think interferes with its ability to associate with the incoming viral capsid.
Okay, so there are differences between the TRIM5-alpha found in old world monkeys and those in humans. Does this tell us anything more about how this factor has evolved and anything broader about the evolution of resistance to HIV and other retroviral infections in general?
Well, humans and retroviruses have been in a long-standing coevolutionary battle. As humans evolve resistance to these viruses evolve new mechanisms for escaping our defenses. So we think there's been some interesting work from Mike Emmerman's lab recently that human TRIM5 may have evolved to resist an ancient retrovirus. And in the course of evolving antiviral activity against that ancient retrovirus, it then lost the ability to potently inhibit infection by HIV-1.
Does anything about the differences or TRIM5-alpha in humans tell us that humans might be in a position to evolve HIV resistance through this factor? Or in fact, do you think there are any humans walking about carrying versions of the TRIM5-alpha gene that might actually be blocking the virus?
Well, we'd certainly like to find those humans if they do exist. As of now, there are several polymorphisms in the human TRIM5-alpha, although we haven't been able to show a strong correlation between these polymorphisms and disease progression. We think that the best way to use TRIM5 therapeutically is either to develop a drug that could enhance the activity of human TRIM5-alpha, help it to recognize the incoming HIV-1 capsid, or possibly use a gene therapy strategy to introduce a human variant that had enhanced HIV-1 antiviral activity.
And do you think there will be many more cellular factors of this kind that will evolve in the future? And you've alluded to the possibility that these could be harnessed therapeutically. Do you think this is a real possibility in the future?
I think there are a lot of other antiviral factors out there, which are sort of called, Paul Bienasch has coined the phrase intrinsic immunity. These are constitutively expressed factors that appear to have strong antiviral activity. And I think there's a lot of those factors still out there waiting to be found. I certainly think that there are a lot of challenges to introducing these factors into humans to enhance our antiviral activity, but that's a good challenge and something that's worth working on.
Matthew, I want to congratulate you on your award-winning essay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Science editor Stephen Simpson talking with Matthew Strömlau in Stockholm, Sweden. Strömlau has just received the grand prize of the GE and Science Prize for Young Life Scientists. You can read his prize-winning essay, Why Old World Monkeys Are Resistant to HIV-1, in the December 7th issue of Science. As the year 2008 begins, so too begins the International Year of the Reef. In a special news focus in this week's Science, you can read articles on spawning, coral disease, and reefs where there are many more predators than prey. Science's Richard Stone edited the series on coral reefs this week, and I spoke with him from our office in Beijing, China.
Next year is the International Year of the Reef, and in New Focus, we decided to ring in this year with a look at some of the issues related to coral reefs that we have not focused on in our coverage in the news section.
Who designates the International Year, and why is 2008 the International Year of the Reef?
The International Year of the Reef is an acknowledgement that reefs are in big trouble. There is a lot of concern both among the scientific community and amongst the general public that reef health is declining. And that's a huge concern because reefs provide a large service for the fishing industry. They are key for tourism. So there's a lot of people's jobs who depend upon healthy reefs. Just from a broader moral perspective, people are concerned that some human activities are involved in the loss of reefs, such as coastal runoff and climate change. So the International Year of the Reef is a coordinated effort among hundreds of scientists to both try to diagnose better some of the problems afflicting reefs and expand research studies on the threats posed to reefs and what might be done to protect reefs. And it's also an effort to try to increase awareness in the public about the plight of reefs. So certainly a lot of coastal communities are aware of this issue, but just to try to broaden that.
Now, with the runoff and the rising temperature as reasons that are thought to be human-related causes for these endangered reefs, I wonder why it is that the reefs themselves are not able to evolve resistance to this kind of activity.
Well, certainly reefs are composed of different species, and the species compositions, the ecosystems, vary from region to region. So some species are better able to adapt to various kinds of threats, but some threats could have a potential global catastrophic effect. And I'm thinking in particular of the rising acid levels. So the more CO2 that gets pumped into the atmosphere, the more gets absorbed into the water column. And as the pH of the ocean increases ever so gradually, it will reach a point eventually where most corals cannot form their carbonate skeleton. I think that most researchers acknowledge that the acidification of the ocean is perhaps the biggest looming threat and one that may prove extremely hard for most coral species to adapt to.
What are some of the efforts that researchers are engaging in to try to help save the reefs?
Well, right now, much of the research focus has been to understand better the threats posed to reefs and how reefs are responding to these varied threats. And there are certainly efforts to try to mitigate the consequences of effects. Largely what needs to be done is to, say, minimize the human impact. So it's not just simply a research question. It's after having established what a lot of these threats are, it's taking more aggressive measures to trying to reduce the human contributions to these threats.
Are there any efforts to try and grow the reefs in other places or to expand their territory?
Yeah, there's certainly efforts to try to restore damaged reefs. And these are fairly small-scale efforts, and they can grow back, but it's not a long-term solution, and it's not a global solution to this problem.
What still needs to be learned other than the impact of human activity on the reefs in terms of helping reestablish or repairing the reef damage that's already been done?
Well, one of the big mysteries of corals is spawning. The sequence of spawning is set off by moonlight, and it's more of an art right now than science for researchers to observe spawning and try to learn exactly about how after spawning occurs, how the coral larvae settle, how they find a new place to build a reef, how some coral larvae actually get swept away far from their home colony, and that's how new reefs might form. So the biology of corals is something that researchers are still trying to get a handle on. The lead article of our focus special issue does look at the biology of coral spawning and what researchers have learned so far, and how they are really grappling with quite a challenge of trying to learn how to rear coral in their own labs. It's something which they haven't fully figured out yet. We also have a piece by a writer who went out with researchers on the Great Barrier Reef for this Acropora spawning that occurred this past October, just to try to show what that research process is like and what sort of questions they're trying to ask as they observe spawning and as they try to rear coral larvae. The other issue that often gets ignored as you look at coral reefs is the predator-prey balance and how overfishing skews the balance, the number of the larger fish versus smaller prey fish. we have a piece of the special issue which explores that topic as well.
Well, it sounds like there'll be a lot more research to come then on this topic. Is that what we can expect with all these scientists dedicating perhaps this next year to that?
Well, I certainly hope so. We have focused quite a lot of attention on the plight of reefs, both in the news section and in the articles written by specialists in science. So we have tracked this issue closely. And I expect that there will be quite a bit of research coming out both the next year during the International Year of the Reef and then in the months that follow as the research projects are wrapped up. Certainly the larger issues, the threat to reef health, they aren't going to go away soon. So research is urgent in trying to better understand coral biology and trying to better understand how humans can both reduce their impact on reefs and protect and restore coral reef health.
Richard Stone, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Nice talking to you.
Science editor Richard Stone on the upcoming International Year of the Reef. Read the news focus on coral reefs in this week's Science. Finally today, Dave Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. So, David, what do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, I've got three cool stories for you. We're going to talk about how a damaged Martian rover may have unearthed evidence of life on the red planet, how a gene turns fruit flies back into virgins, and finally, clues to why obesity makes people more prone to bacterial infections.
The damaged Martian rover, huh? Is this Spirit or Opportunity?
It's Spirit, and Spirit has been entering some hard times lately on the Martian surface. Its solar cells are coated with dust, and its power has been drained to about 42% of peak capacity. And to add insult to injury, its front right wheel has been stuck for the past 2 years, so that when Spirit churns along the Martian surface, it's actually dragging its wheel along the ground.
So it's going backwards.
Yes, exactly. It's driving backwards. But there's a silver lining, it turns out, to this busted wheel. A NASA scientist announced this week at a meeting of the American Geophysical Union in San Francisco that this wheel, when it was dragged along, scraped some of the red dust off the Martian surface and unearthed an interesting bright white layer underneath.
Okay, so what is it?
Well, whatever it is, it got the mission controllers really excited. So they started doing some spectrographic analysis, but they wanted even more details. So they instructed Spirit to start crushing some of these small, sort of fist-sized rocks that were present in this layer. And Spirit did that. The team analyzed this crushed powder, and what they found is the rock contained about 98% silica. And that's really interesting because such types of rocks only are known, at least on Earth, to form by two processes, either by minerals that get crystallized from hot springs or by forming from fumaroles, which are steamy caustic volcanic vents.
Both good places to grow life, I presume.
Right. In fact, in Yellowstone National Park in the United States, both these environments support hardy microbes and are actually thought to be places similar to those where life may have first evolved on Earth. So this is a really interesting clue that such processes may have also taken place on Mars at some point.
More analysis to come then.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, from what may have been a steamy Mars to steamy relations between flies. How does a gene turn flies back into virgins?
Well, it's a good question, but first we have to back up a little bit. When flies mate, it turns out the female fruit fly is a very faithful lover. And what that means is that after she mates, she spurns all other males for a few days and focuses all her attention on laying eggs that were sired by the male she mated with. Researchers have wondered for a long time what causes this monogamous behavior, at least this temporarily monogamous behavior in fruit flies. And a few years ago, they got one clue, a protein called sex peptide, appropriately enough. And what was happening with this protein is that when male flies had sex with the female flies, they would inject this protein, and this would cause the females to be monogamous, at least for a few days, and just focus on laying eggs.
So this protein was injected along with the sperm.
Right. And what researchers wanted to find out was, what was the target of this protein? How was it causing its effect? So what they did was they basically created a massive fly orgy.
An orgy, huh? How many participants?
13,000 males and 13,000 females. But the researchers added a twist. With each female, they knocked out a different gene in each fly using a technique called RNA interference. And what they were looking for was a female fly who would keep on mating after she mated with a male and would stop laying eggs. In other words, a female fly that was acting like a virgin even though she had already just mated. And they found one fly that fit the bill. And what they did was, after they found this fly, they used glowing antibodies to figure out exactly what gene it was that they had turned off. And they found the gene, which they called SP receptor. And what was interesting is the gene seemed to be clustered in a part of the brain known to be involved in mating behavior. So that made a lot of sense.
Did the males have this gene too?
The males have this gene too, but it's not clear what it does in the males. But at least in the females now, the researchers have found the target of the sex peptide, and now they know a whole lot more about what it takes to turn a female fly that's just had sex back into a virgin.
How are they going to apply this knowledge?
Right. Well, it's not just interesting in its own right. It actually could have applications for malaria. And Rob, as you know, malaria is spread by mosquitoes. And if there are enough similarities between flies and mosquitoes, which there probably are, if they can find a way to disrupt this gene in mosquitoes, they would turn female mosquitoes into sex maniacs, basically, that would always be looking for sex and not laying eggs. And therefore, you could really cause the population to plummet dramatically because the females aren't focusing the energy on laying eggs. They're focusing their energy on finding another guy.
So it's a choice for the females to lay eggs. It doesn't just happen to them like mammals do when they get pregnant?
Right. It appears to be a choice.
Well, from a possible strategy for combating malaria to a possible strategy for preventing bacteria infections?
Well, Rob, this last story deals with this idea that obese people tend to be more prone to certain diseases, like heart disease and diabetes and even certain cancers. And they also appear to have a weakened immune system. But researchers really didn't know why. And so they decided to look at this idea in mice. And so they started with this hypothesis that somehow obesity compromises the body's immune system and therefore makes it more susceptible to disease. And to test this in mice, what they did was they basically took some mice and plumped them up. They fed them a high-calorie diet until they had a group of mice that weighed about 1.5 times what a normal mouse would weigh. And then they gave these mice a gum infection.
Gingivitis?
Exactly, gingivitis. And the way they did this was they took the bacteria that causes gingivitis and they put it in a solution and they dipped a silk thread into the solution. And then they wrapped this silk thread around the mouse's teeth. And what they found was that the mice that were obese had 40% more bone loss around the roots of their teeth than the lean mice.
So all the mice got gingivitis, it's just that it affected the obese mice worse.
Right. And what's more is when the researchers did further tests and they injected some of this bacteria into the mouse tails, what they found is that a lot of immune proteins and a lot of the immune system pathways were much more compromised in the obese mice than they were in the normal mice. So this was further evidence that somehow obesity is inhibiting the immune system's ability to respond to bacterial infection. And this has implications to humans because obviously we get gingivitis, and bacterial infections of the mouth are known to increase the risk of diseases like heart attack and stroke. So if it's happening in obese mice, it could mean that similar things are happening in obese people.
But that's not something that any ethics committee would allow you to test.
Right. I doubt any researcher out there is going to be giving people gingivitis, and I don't know of too many people that would sign up for that study.
Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories can we expect to see on Science Now?
Well, we're looking into a story about why pregnant women don't tip over, about how reprogrammed stem cells can treat muscular dystrophy, and finally, how orangutans mimic each other's facial expressions during play.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the December 14th, 2007 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.